Saarin and Eukiri were the daughters of innkeepers, Tallinn of farmers, while Dosine's father had been a cutler. Saarin had been trained first by the Daughters of Silence, the only one of that lot to reach the shawl. Absolutely useless drivel. Suddenly something did strike her and dried her throat. Saarin, with her temper often barely in rein. Dosine, who had actually run away 3 times as a novice, though she had only once made it as far as the bridges. Tallinn, who might have earned more punishments than any other novice in the history of the tower. Eukiri, always the last grey to join her sister's consensus when she wanted to go another way, the last to join the halls, for that matter. All 4 were considered rebels in a way, and Elida had humiliated every one. Could they be thinking they had made a mistake, standing to depose Swan and raise Elida? Could they have found out about Zera and the others? And if so, what did they intend to do? Mentally, Ciane prepared herself to weave Sidar, though without much hope that she could escape. Pevara matched Saarin and Eukiri in strength, but she herself was weaker than any here save Dosine. She prepared herself, and Tallinn stepped forward and burst all of her logical deductions to flinders. "Eukiri noticed you two sneaking about together, and we want to know why." Her surprisingly deep voice held heat, despite the ice that seemed to coat her face. "Did the heads of your Ajahs set you a secret task?" In public, the Ajahs' heads snarl at one another worse than anyone else, but they've been sneaking off into corners to talk, it seems. Whatever they're scheming, the hall has a right to know. "Oh, do give over, Tallinn." Yukiri's voice was always an even bigger surprise than Tallinn's. The woman looked a miniature queen, in dark silver silk with ivory lace, but she sounded a comfortable countrywoman. She claimed the contrast helped in negotiations. She smiled at Ciane and Pevara, a monarch perhaps unsure how gracious she should be. "I saw the pair of you sniffing about like ferrets at the hen coop," she said, "but I held my tongue. You might be pillow friends for all I know, and whose business is that but yours? I held my tongue till Tallinn here started yelping about who's been huddling in corners. I've seen a bit of huddling in corners myself, and I suspect some of those women might head their Ajahs as well, so sometimes 6 and 6 make a dozen, and sometimes they make a mess. Tell us if you can, now. The hall does have a right." "We are not leaving until you do tell," Tallinn put in even more heatedly than before. Pevara snorted and folded her arms. "If the head of my Ajah spoke 2 words to me, I'd see no reason to tell you what they were. As it happens, what Ciane and I were discussing has nothing to do with the red or the white. Snoop elsewhere." But she did not release Sidar. Neither did Ciane. "Bloody useless, and I bloody knew it," Dosine muttered from her place by the door. "Why I ever flaming let you talk me into this? Just as bloody well nobody else knows, or we'd have sheep's wallop all over faces for the whole bloody tower to see." At times she had a tongue like a boy, too. A boy who needed his mouth washed out. Ciane would have stood to leave if she had not feared her knees would betray her. Pevara did stand, and raised an impatient eyebrow at the women between her and the door. Saarin fingered her knife-hilt and eyed them quizzically, not shifting a step. "A puzzle," she murmured. Suddenly she glided forward, her free hand dipping into Ciane's lap so quickly that Ciane gasped. She tried to keep the oath rod hidden, but the only result was that she ended with Saarin holding the rod waist high with one hand, while she held the other end and a fistful of her skirts. "I enjoy puzzles," Saarin said. Ciane let go and adjusted her dress. There seemed nothing else to do. The appearance of the rod produced a momentary babble as nearly everyone spoke at once. "Blood and fire," Dosine growled. "Are you down here raising new bloody sisters?" "Oh, leave it with them, Saarin," Eukiri laughed right on top of her. "Whatever they're up to, it's their own business." Atop both, Tallinn barked, "Why else are they sneaking about together, if it isn't to do with the Ajah heads?" Saarin waved a hand and after a moment gained quiet. All present were sitters, but she had the right to speak first in the hall, and her 40 years counted for something, too. "This is the key to the puzzle, I think," she said, stroking the rod with her thumb. "Why this, after all?" Abruptly the glow of Sidar surrounded her, too, and she channeled spirit to the rod. Under the light I will speak no word that is not true. I am not a dark friend. In the silence that followed, a mouse sneezing would have sounded loud. Am I right? Saren said, releasing the power. She held the rod out toward Cian. For the third time Cian retook the oath against lying, and for the second time repeated that she was not of the Black. Pevara did the same with frozen dignity, and eyes sharp as an eagle's. This is ridiculous, Tallien said. There is no Black Aja. Yukiri took the rod from Pevara and channeled. Under the light I will speak no word that is not true. I am not Black Aja. The light of Sidar around her winked out, and she handed the rod to Dosine. Tallien frowned in disgust. Stand aside, Dosine. I, for one, will not put up with this filthy suggestion. Under the light, I will speak no word that is not true, Dosine said almost reverently, the glow around her like a halo. I am not of the Black Aja. When matters were serious, her tongue was as clean as any mistress of novices could have wished. She extended the rod to Tallien. The golden-haired woman started back as from a poisonous snake. Even to ask this is a slander. Worse than slander. Something feral moved in her eyes. An irrational thought, perhaps, but that was what Cian saw. Now move out of my way, Tallien demanded, with all the authority of a sitter in her voice. I am leaving. I think not, Pevara said quietly, and Yukiri nodded slowly in agreement. Saren did not stroke her knife hilt. She gripped it till her knuckles went white. Riding through the deep snows of Andor, floundering through them, Tovain Ghazal cursed the day she was born. Short and slightly plump, with smooth copper skin and long, glossy, dark hair, she had seemed pretty to many over the years, but none had ever called her beautiful. Certainly none would now. The dark eyes that had once been direct now bored into whatever she looked at. That was when she was not angry. She was angry today. When Tovain was angry, serpents fled. Four other reds rode, floundered, at her back, and behind them 20 of the tower guard in dark coats and cloaks. None of the men liked it that their armor was stowed away on the pack horses, and they watched the forest lining both sides of the road as though expecting attack any moment. How they thought to cross 300 miles of Andor unnoticed, wearing coats and cloaks with the flame of Tar Valon shining bright on them, Tovain could not imagine. The journey was almost done, though. In another day, perhaps two, with roads knee-deep in snow on the horses, she would join with 9 other parties exactly like hers. Not all of the sisters in them were red, unfortunately, but that did not trouble her over much. Tovain Ghazal, once a sitter for the Red, would go into the histories as the woman who destroyed this Black Tower. She was sure Elida thought her grateful for the chance, called back from exile and disgrace, given the opportunity for redemption. She sneered, and if a wolf had been looking into the deep hood of her cloak, it might have quailed. What had been done 20 years ago was necessary, and the light burn all those who muttered that the Black Aja must have been involved. It had been necessary and right, but Tovain Ghazal had been driven from her chair in the hall and forced to howl for mercy under the birch, with the assembled sisters watching, and even novices and accepted witnessing that sitters too lay beneath the law, though they were not told what law. And then she had been sent to work these last 20 years on the isolated Black Hills farm of Mistress Jara D'Oweel, a woman who considered an Aes Sedai serving penance in exile no different from any other hand laboring in sun and snow. Tovain's hands shifted on her reins. She could feel the calluses. Mistress D'Oweel, even now she could not think of the woman without the honorific she had demanded. Mistress D'Oweel believed in hard work, and discipline as tight as any novice faced. She had no mercy on anyone who tried to shirk the back-breaking labor that she herself shared, and less than none for a woman who sneaked away to comfort herself with a pretty boy. That had been Tovain's life these past 20 years, and Elida had slipped through the cracks uncaught, danced her way to the Ammerlin seat that Tovain had once dreamed of for herself. No, she was not grateful, but she had learned to wait her chance. Abruptly, a tall man in a black coat, dark hair falling to his shoulders, spurred his horse out of the forest into the road ahead of her, spraying snow. "There's no point struggling," he announced firmly, raising a gloved hand. "Surrender peacefully, and no one will be hurt." It was neither his appearance nor his words that made Tovain rein up short, letting the other sisters gather beside her. "Take him," she said calmly. "You had better link. He has me shielded." It seemed one of these Ashaman had come to her. How convenient of him. Abruptly she realized that nothing was happening and took her eyes from the fellow to frown at Janair. The woman's pale, square face seemed absolutely bloodless. "Tovain," she said unsteadily, "I also am shielded." "I am shielded too," Lamai breathed in disbelief, and the others chimed in, increasingly frantic. "All shielded." More men in black coats appeared from among the trees, their horses stepping slowly all around. Tovain stopped counting at 15. The guards muttered angrily, waiting on a sister's command. They knew nothing yet except that a band of rogues had waylaid them. Tovain clicked her tongue in irritation. These men could not all channel, of course, but apparently every Ashaman who could do so had come against her. She did not panic. Unlike some of the sisters with her, these were not the first men who channeled that she had confronted. The tall man began riding toward her, smiling, apparently thinking they had obeyed his ridiculous order. "At my command," she said quietly, "we will break in every direction. As soon as you are far enough away that the man loses the shield..." Men always thought they had to be able to see to hold their weaves, which meant that they did have to. "Turn back and help the guards. Ready yourselves." She raised her voice to a shout. "Guardsmen, fight them!" Roaring, the guardsmen surged forward, waving their swords and no doubt thinking to surround and protect the sisters. Pulling her mare around to the right, Tovain dug in her heels and crouched low over Sparrow's neck, dodging between startled guardsmen, then between two very young men in black coats who gaped at her in astonishment. Then she was into the trees, urging more speed, snow spraying wildly, careless of whether the mare broke a leg. She liked the animal, but more than a horse would die today. Behind her, shouts, and one voice roaring through all the cacophony, the tall man's voice. "Take them alive, by order of the Dragon Reborn! Harmonize, Sedai, and you'll answer to me!" By order of the Dragon Reborn. For the first time, Tovain felt fear, an icicle worming into her middle. The Dragon Reborn. She thrashed Sparrow's neck with the reins. The shield was still on her. Surely there were enough trees between them already to block the cursed men's sight of her. Oh, light! The Dragon Reborn! She grunted as something struck her across the middle. A branch, where there was no branch, snatching her out of the saddle. She hung there, watching Sparrow plow off at as much of a gallop as the snow allowed. She hung there, in the middle of the air, arms trapped at her sides, feet dangling a pace or more above the ground. She swallowed, hard. It had to be the male part of the power holding her up. She had never been touched by Saidin before. She could feel the thick band of nothing snug around her middle. She thought she could feel the Dark One's taint. She quivered, fighting down screams. The tall man reined his horse to a halt in front of her, and she floated down to sit sideways in front of his saddle. He did not seem particularly interested in the Aes Sedai he had captured, though. "Ardlin!" he shouted. "Norley! Kajima! One of you bloody young louts, come here now!" He was very tall, with shoulders and axe handle wide. That was how Mistress DeWeel would have put it, just short of his middle years, handsome in a brooding, rugged fashion. Not at all like the pretty boys Tovain liked, eager and grateful and so easily controlled. A silver sword decorated the tall collar of his black wool coat on one side, with a peculiar creature in gold and red enamel on the other. He was a man who could channel, and he had her shielded and a prisoner. The shriek that burst from her throat startled even her. She would have held it back if she could, but another leaped out behind it, higher still, and another even higher, another and another. Kicking wildly, she flung herself from side to side, useless against the power. She knew that, but only in a tiny corner of her mind. The rest of her howled at the top of her lungs, howled wordless pleas for rescue from the shadow. Screaming, she struggled like a mad beast. Dimly, she was aware of his horse plunging and dancing as her heels drummed its shoulder. Dimly, she heard the man talking. "Easy, you lump-eared sack of coal! Calm down, sister, I'm not going to—" "Easy, you spavined mule! Light! My apologies, sister, but this is how we learn to do it." And then he kissed her. She had only a heartbeat to realize his lips were touching hers. Then sight vanished and warmth flooded through her. More than warmth. She was melted honey inside, bubbling honey, rushing toward the boil. She was a harp string, vibrating faster and faster, vibrating to invisibility and faster still. She was a thin crystal vase, quivering on the brink of shattering. The harp string broke. The vase shattered. "Ah!" At first she did not realize that sound had come from her gaping mouth. For a moment she could not think coherently. Panting, she stared up at the male face above her, wondering who it belonged to. Yes, the tall man. The man who could... "I could have done without the extra bit," he sighed, patting the horse's neck. The animal snorted, but it no longer leaped about. "Yet I suppose it is necessary. You're hardly a wife. Be calm. Don't try to escape. Don't attack anyone in a black coat. And don't touch the source unless I give you permission. Now what's your name?"
Unless he gave permission? The effrontery of the man!
"Tovain Ghazal," she said, and blinked. Now why had she answered him?
"There you are,"
another black-coated man said, splashing his horse through the snow to them. This one would be much more to her liking, if he could not actually channel, at least. She doubted this pink-cheeked lad shaved more than twice in the week.
"Light, Loghain!" the pretty boy exclaimed. "Did you take a second one? The Mahale won't like that. I don't think he likes us taking any. Maybe it won't matter, though, you two being so close and all."
"Close, Vinchova," Loghain said wryly. "If the Mahale had his way, I'd be hoeing turnips with the new boys. Or buried under the field," he added in a mutter she did not think he meant to be heard.
However much he heard, the pretty boy laughed with incredulous disbelief. Tovain barely heard him. She was gazing up at the man looming over her. Loghain, the false dragon. But he was dead, stilled and dead, and holding her before his saddle with a casual hand. Why was she not screaming or striking at him? Even her belt knife would do this near. Yet she had no desire at all to reach for the ivory haft. She could, she realized. That band around her middle was gone. She could at least slip down off the horse and try to... She had no desire to do that either.
"What did you do to me?" she demanded, calmly.
At least she had managed to hold on to that. Turning his horse to ride back to the road, Loghain told her what he had done, and she put her head against that wide chest, not caring at all how big he was, and wept. She was going to make Elida pay for this, she vowed. If Loghain ever let her, she would. That last was an especially bitter thought. Chapter 27. The Bargain. Seated cross-legged in a heavily gilded, high-backed chair, Min tried to lose herself in the leather-bound copy of Herod Fell's Reason and Unreason lying open on her knees. It was not easy. Oh, the book itself was mesmerizing. Master Fell's writings always swept her into worlds she thought she had not dreamed of while working in stables. She very much regretted the sweet old man's death. She hoped to find a clue in his books to why he had been killed. Her dark ringlets swung as she shook her head and tried to apply herself. The book was fascinating, but the room was oppressive. Rand's small throne room in the Sun Palace was thick with gilt, from the wide cornices to the tall mirrors on the walls replacing those Rand had smashed, from the two rows of chairs like the one she had sat in, to the dais at the head of the rows, and the dragon throne atop the dais. That was a monstrosity, in the style of tier as imagined by Kyrianan craftsmen, resting on the backs of a pair of dragons, with two more dragons for the arms and others climbing the back, all with large sunstones for eyes, the whole glittering with gilt and red enamel. A huge golden wavy-rayed rising sun set in the polished stone floor,
only added to the sense of heaviness. At least the fires blazing in two great fireplaces, tall enough for her to walk into, gave a pleasing warmth, especially with snow spilling down outside. And these were Rand's rooms. The comfort of that alone outweighed any amount of oppression. An irritating thought. This was Rand's room if he ever deigned to return. A very irritating thought. Being in love with a man seemed to consist largely of a great many irritating admissions to yourself. Shifting in a vain attempt to make the hard chair comfortable, she tried to read, but her eyes kept swinging to the tall doors, each climbed by its own line of gilded rising suns. She hoped to see Rand walk in. She feared to see Soralia or Cadswain. Unconsciously, she adjusted her pale blue coat, fingering the tiny snowflowers embroidered on the lapels. More twined around the sleeves, and the legs of breeches made as snug as she could manage to wriggle herself into. Not that great a change from what she had always worn. Not really. So far she had avoided dresses, however much embroidery she wore, but she very much feared that Soralia meant to stuff her into a dress if the Wise One had to peel her out of what she was wearing with her own hands. The woman knew all about her and Rand. All about. She felt her cheeks heating. Soralia seemed to be trying to decide whether Min Farshaw was a suitable lover for Rand Althor. That word made her feel foolishly giddy. She was not a fluff-brained girl. That word made her want to look over her shoulder guiltily for the ants who had raised her. No, she thought wryly, you're not fluff-brained. Fluff has its wits about it compared to you. Or maybe Soralia wanted to know whether Rand was suitable for Min. It seemed that way at times. The Wise Ones accepted Min as one of them, or very nearly, but these past weeks Soralia had wrung her out like a laundress's mangle. The leather-faced, white-haired Wise One wanted to know every scrap about Min and every shred about Rand. She wanted the dust from the bottoms of his pockets. Twice Min had tried balking at the incessant interrogation, and twice Soralia had produced a switch. That terrible old woman simply bundled her over the side of the nearest table and afterward told her that maybe that would loosen another scrap in her head. None of the other Wise Ones gave the slightest commiseration either. Light, the things you had to put up with for a man, and she could not have him for herself alone at that. Cadswain was a different proposition altogether. The immensely dignified Aes Sedai, as gray-haired as Soralia was white, did not seem to care two figs for Min or Rand either one, but she spent a great deal of time in the Sun Palace. Avoiding her entirely was impossible. She seemed to wander wherever she wanted. And when Cadswain looked at Min, however briefly, Min could not help seeing a woman who could teach bulls to dance and bears to sing. She kept expecting the woman to point at her and announce that it was time Min Farshaw learned to balance a ball on her nose. Sooner or later, Rand had to face Cadswain again, and the thought tied Min's stomach in knots. She made herself bend back over her book. One of the doors swung open, and Rand strolled in with the dragon scepter nestled in the crook of his arm. He wore a golden crown, a broad circlet of laurel leaves. That must be this crown of swords everyone was talking about. Snug breeches that showed his legs to advantage, and a gold-worked green silk coat that fit him beautifully. He was beautiful. Marking her place with the note Master Fell had written, saying she was too pretty, she carefully closed the book and carefully set it on the floor beside her chair. Then she folded her arms and waited. Had she been standing, she would have tapped her foot, but she would not have the man thinking she was springing up just because he finally appeared. For a moment he stood smiling at her, and tugging his earlobe for some reason. He seemed to be humming. Then abruptly he swung round to frown at the doors. "The maidens out there didn't tell me you were in here. They hardly said a word at all. Light, they looked ready to veil at the sight of me." "Maybe they are upset," she said calmly. "Maybe they wondered where you were, the way I did. Maybe they wondered whether you were hurt or sick or cold, the way I did," she thought bitterly. The man looked confused. "I wrote to you," he said slowly, and she sniffed. "Twice. With Ashaman to deliver your letters, you wrote twice, Rand Althor, if you call it writing." He staggered as if she had slapped him. No, as if she had kicked him in the belly, and blinked. She took a firm hold on herself and settled against the chair back. Give a man sympathy at the wrong moment, and you never regained the ground lost. A part of her wanted to throw her arms around him, comfort him, draw out all his pains, soothe all his hurts. He had so many, and refused to admit a one. She was not going to spring up and rush to him, gushing to know what was wrong or light. He had to be all right. Something took her gently beneath the elbows and lifted her out of the chair. Blue boots dangling, she floated toward him through the air. The dragon scepter floated away from him. So, he thought he could smile, did he? He thought a pretty smile could turn her around? She opened her mouth to give him a piece of her mind. A very sharp piece. Folding his arms around her, he kissed her. When she could breathe again, she peered up at him through her lashes.
The first time...
She swallowed to clear her voice. First, Jahar Narishma stalked in, trying to stare inside everybody's skull the way he does, and vanished after handing me a scrap of parchment. Let me see. It said, "I have claimed the crown of Ilion. Trust no one until I return. Rand." A little short of a proper love letter, I'd say. He kissed her again. This time, getting her breath back took longer. This was not going as she had expected at all. On the other hand, it was not going very badly. The second time, Jonan Adley delivered a bit of paper that said, "I will return when I finish here. Trust no one. Rand." Adley walked in on me in my bath, she added, and he wasn't shy about getting an eyeful. Rand always tried to pretend he was not jealous, as if there were a man in the world who was not. But she had noticed his scowls at men who looked at her, and his very considerable ardor was more heated afterward, too. She wondered what this kiss would be like. Maybe she should suggest retiring to the bedchamber? No, she would not be that forward, no matter. Rand set her down, his face suddenly bleak. "Adley's dead," he said. Suddenly the crown flew from his head, spinning the length of the room as though hurled. Just when she thought it would crash into the back of the dragon throne, perhaps smash through it, the wide ring of gold stopped short and settled slowly onto the throne seat. Min's breath caught as she looked up at him. Blood glistened in the dark red curls above his left ear. Pulling a lace-edged handkerchief from her sleeve, she reached for his temple, but he caught her wrist. "I killed him," he said quietly. She shivered at the sound of his voice. Quiet, the way the grave was quiet. Perhaps the bedchamber was a very good idea, no matter how forward it was. Making herself smile, and blushing when she realized how easy it was to smile, thinking of that huge bed, she gripped the front of his shirt, preparing to rip shirt and coat from his back right then and there. Someone knocked at the doors. Min's hand sprang away from Rand's shirt. She sprang away, too. Who could it be, she wondered irritably. The maidens either announced visitors when Rand was there or simply sent them in. "Come," he said loudly, giving her a rueful smile, and she blushed again at that. Dobraine put his head in at the door, then entered and shut the door behind him when he saw them standing together. The Kyrianin lord was a small man, little taller than she, with the front of his head shaved and the rest of his mostly gray hair falling to his shoulders. Stripes of blue and white decorated the front of his nearly black coat to below his waist. Even before gaining Rand's favor, he had been a power in the land. Now he ruled here, at least until Elaine could claim the Sun Throne.
"My Lord Dragon," he murmured, bowing. "My Lady Taviren."
"A joke," Min muttered when Rand quirked an eyebrow at her.
"Perhaps," Dobraine said, shrugging slightly. "Yet half the noble women in the city now wear bright colors in imitation of the Lady Min, breeches that display their legs, and many in coats that do not even cover their—"
He coughed discreetly, realizing that Min's coat did not cover her hips completely. She thought about telling him he had very pretty legs, even if they were decidedly knobby, then quickly thought better. Rand's jealousy might be a wonderful flame if they were alone, but she did not want him striking out at Dobraine. He was capable of that, she feared. Besides, she thought it really was a slip. Lord Dobraine Taborwin was not the sort to make even slightly rough jokes.
"So you're changing the world, too, Min."
Grinning, Rand tapped the tip of her nose with a finger. He tapped her nose, like a child he was amused with. Worse, she felt herself grinning back at him like a fool.
"In better ways than I am, it appears," he went on, and that momentary boyish grin faded like mist.
"Is all well in Tyr and Ilion, my lord dragon?" Dobraine inquired. "In Tyr and Ilion all is well," Rand replied grimly. "What do you have for me, Dobraine? Sit, man, sit."
He motioned toward the rows of chairs and took one for himself.
"I have acted on all of your letters," Dobraine said, seating himself across from Rand, "but there is little good to report, I fear."
"I'll get us something to drink," Min said in a tight voice.
"Letters?"
It was not easy to stalk in heeled boots. She had grown accustomed to them, but the things made you sway, whatever you did. Not easy, yet enough anger made anything possible. She stalked to the small gilded table beneath one of the huge mirrors where a silver pitcher and goblets sat. She busied herself with pouring spiced wine, splashing it out furiously. The servants always brought extra goblets in case she had visitors, though she seldom did except for Soralia or a fool lot of noblewomen. The wine was barely warm, but it was more than hot enough for the likes of that pair. She had received 2 letters, but she would bet Dobraine had had 10, 20. Banging pitcher and goblets about, she listened carefully. What had they been up to behind her back with their dozens of letters?
"Toram Riotan appears to have vanished," Dobraine said, "though rumor at least says he still lives, worse luck. Rumors also say that David Hanlon and Geral Mordeth, Padan Fine, as you call the man, have deserted him. By the way, I have settled Toram's sister, the Lady Ailill, in generous apartments, with servants who are trustworthy."
By his tone, he clearly meant trustworthy toward himself. The woman would not be able to change her dress without him knowing.
"I can understand bringing her here and Lord Bertome and the others, but why High Lord Wyramon, or High Lady Anayala? It goes without saying, of course, that their servants also are trustworthy."
"How do you know when a woman wants to kill you?" Rand mused.
"When she knows your name?"
Dobraine did not sound as if he were joking. Rand tilted his head thoughtfully, then nodded. Nodded? She hoped he was not still hearing voices. Rand gestured as if brushing away the women who wanted to kill him. A dangerous thing, with her about. She did not want to kill him, certainly, but she would not mind seeing Soralia go at him with that switch. Breeches did not give much protection.
"Wyramon is a fool who makes too many mistakes," Rand told Dobraine, who nodded sober agreement. "My mistake for thinking I could use him. He seems happy enough to stay near the Dragon Reborn in any case. What else?"
Min handed him a goblet, and he smiled at her despite the wine that slopped over his wrist. Maybe he thought it was an accident.
"Little else and too much," Dobraine began, then jerked back in his chair to avoid spilling wine as Min shoved the second silver goblet at him. She had not liked her brief stint as a tavern maid. "My thanks, my Lady Min," he murmured graciously. But he eyed her askance as he took the goblet. She walked calmly back to fetch her own wine. Calmly. "I fear that Lady Caroline and the High Lord Darlin are in Lady Arilyn's palace here in the city," the Kyrianan lord went on, "under the protection of Cadswain Sedai. Perhaps protection is not the correct word. I have been refused entry to see them, but I hear that they have attempted to leave the city and been brought back like sacks."
"In a sack," one story claims.
"Having met Cadswain, I can almost believe it."
"Cadswain," Rand murmured, and Min felt a chill. He did not sound afraid, precisely, yet he did sound more than uneasy.
"What do you think I should do about Caroline and Darlin, Min?"
Settling into a chair 2 away from him, Min jerked at suddenly being included. Ruefully she stared down at the wine soaking through her best cream-silk blouse, and her breeches, too. "Caroline will support Elaine for the Sun Throne," she said glumly. For warm wine it seemed very cold, and she doubted the stain would ever come out of the blouse. "Not a viewing, but I believe her." She did not glance toward Dobraine, though he nodded sagely. Everyone knew about her viewings now. The only result had been a stream of noblewomen who wanted to know their futures, and right sulky, too, when she said she could not tell them. Most would not have been pleased with the little she had seen. Nothing dire,
but not at all the bright wonders that fortune-tellers at the fair forecast. As for Darlin, aside from the fact that he'll marry Caroline after she's wrung him out and hung him up to dry, all I can say is that one day he'll be a king. I saw the crown on his head, a thing with a sword on the front of it, but I don't know what country it belongs to. And, oh yes, he'll die in bed and she will survive him. Dobraine choked on his wine, spluttering and dabbing at his lips with a plain linen handkerchief. Most of those who knew did not believe. Quite satisfied with herself, Min drank the little that remained in her goblet. And then she was choking and gasping, jerking her handkerchief from her sleeve to wipe at her mouth. Light! She would have to give herself the dregs. Rand simply nodded, peering into his goblet. "So they will live to trouble me," he murmured. A very soft sound, for words like stone. He was hard as a blade, her sheep-herder. "And what do I do about—" Abruptly he twisted in his chair toward the doors. One was opening. He had very sharp ears. Min had heard nothing. Neither of the two Aes Sedai who entered was Cadswain, and Min felt her shoulders loosen as she tucked her handkerchief away. While Rafaela shut the door, Mirana curtsied deeply to Rand, though the Grey Sister's hazel eyes took in Min and Dobraine and filed them away, and then the round-faced Rafaela was spreading her deep blue skirts wide, too. Neither rose until Rand gestured. They glided to him wearing cool serenity as they did their dresses, except that the plump blue sister fingered her shawl briefly, as though to remind herself it was there. Min had seen that gesture before, from other sisters who had sworn fealty to Rand. It could not be easy for them. Only the White Tower commanded Aes Sedai, but Rand crooked a finger and they came, pointed and they went. Aes Sedai spoke with kings and queens as equal, perhaps slightly as their betters, yet the wise ones called them apprentices and expected them to obey twice as fast as Rand did. None of that showed on Mirana's smooth face. "My Lord Dragon," she said respectfully, "we only just learned that you had returned, and we thought you might be eager to learn how matters went with the Atha An Mier." She merely glanced at Dobraine, but he rose immediately. Kyrianen were used to people wanting to speak in private. "Dobraine can stay," Rand said curtly. Had he hesitated? He did not stand. His eyes like blue ice, he was being the dragon reborn for all he was worth. Min had told him these women were his in truth, that all five who had accompanied him to the sea folk ship were his, utterly loyal to their oath and therefore obedient to his will, yet he seemed to find trusting any Aes Sedai difficult. She understood, but he was going to have to learn how. "As you wish," Mirana replied, inclining her head briefly. "Rafaela and I have reached a bargain with the sea folk." "The bargain, they call it." The difference was clear to the ear. Hands lying still on grey-slashed green skirts, she drew a deep breath. She needed it. "Harina din Togara Two-Winds, wave mistress of Clan Shodane, speaking for Nesta din Rias Two-Moons, mistress of the ships to the Atha An Mier, and thus binding all the Atha An Mier, has promised such ships as the Dragon Reborn needs, to sail when and where he needs them, for whatever purposes he requires." Mirana did seem to grow a touch pontifical when there were no wise ones around. The wise ones did not allow it. "In return, Rafaela and I, speaking for you, promised that the Dragon Reborn will not change any laws of the Atha An Mier, as he has done among the—" For a moment she faltered. "Forgive me. I am used to delivering agreements exactly as made." The word they used was shorebound. "But what they mean is what you have done in Tyr and Kyrian." A question appeared in her eyes and was gone. Perhaps she was wondering whether he had done the same in Ilion. She had expressed relief that he had changed nothing in her native Andor. "I suppose I can live with that," he muttered. "Secondly," Rafaela took up, folding plump hands at her waist, "you must give the Atha An Mier land, a square 1 mile on a side, at every city on navigable water that you control now or come to control." She sounded less pompous than her companion, but only just. Nor did she sound entirely pleased with what she was saying. She was Tyran, after all, and few ports held a tighter control on their trade than Tyr.
Within that area, the laws of the Athan Mir are to hold sway above any others. This agreement must also be made by the rulers of those ports, so that—" It was her turn to falter, and her dark cheeks turned a trifle gray.
"So the agreement will survive me," Rand said dryly.
He barked a laugh. "I can live with that, too."
"Every city on water?" Dobraine exclaimed. "Do they mean here, too?"
He leaped to his feet and began pacing, spilling more of his wine than Min had. He did not seem to notice.
"A mile square? Under the light alone knows what peculiar laws. I've traveled on a seafolk ship, and it is peculiar. Bare legs are not in it. And what of the customs duties and docking fees and—"
Suddenly he rounded on Rand. He scowled at the Aes Sedai, who paid him no mind, but it was to Rand he spoke, in a tone bordering on roughness.
"They will ruin Kyrian in a year, my Lord Dragon. They will ruin any port where you allow them to do this."
Min agreed, silently, but Rand merely waved a hand and laughed again.
"They may think so, but I know something of this, Dobraine. They didn't say who chooses the land, so it doesn't have to be on the water at all. They'll have to buy their food from you and live with your laws when they leave, so they can't be too arrogant. At worst, you can collect your customs when the goods come out of their sanctuary. For the rest, if I can accept it, you can too."
There was no laughter in his voice now, and Dobraine bowed his head. Min wondered where he had learned all that. He sounded a king, and one who knew what he was doing. Maybe Elaine had taught him.
"Secondly implies more," Rand said to the two Aes Sedai.
Mirana and Rafaela exchanged glances, unconsciously touched skirts and shawls, and then Mirana spoke, her voice not at all pompous. In fact, it was much too light. "Thirdly, the Dragon Reborn agrees to keep an ambassador chosen by the Athaan Mir with him at all times. Harina Din Togara has named herself. She will be accompanied by her Windfinder, her Swordmaster, and a retinue."
"What?" Rand roared, springing from the chair.
Rafaela rushed ahead, as though afraid he might cut her off. "And fourthly, the Dragon Reborn agrees to go promptly to a summons from the mistress of the ships, but not more than twice in any 3 consecutive years." She finished panting a little, trying to make the last sound like extenuation. The dragon scepter flew from the floor behind Rand, and he snagged it out of the air without looking.